This is your Faces in the News reporter. Today's face, red one. It belongs to truck driver Joseph Swanson. Joe, how do you like your picture in the paper?
Pretty good, but it's not the first time my picture's been in the paper. Once when I was 13, there was some kind of an epidemic around, and the picture was taken of me standing in line waiting to get a shot from a doctor.
And the picture of you that appeared in the paper yesterday, the one showing your truck wedged in under the Harvey Township underpass, was it as enjoyable as the picture you just discussed?
Well, the picture of me standing in front of my truck shows me...
with a perplexed look as you stare at the contents of your truck spilled all over the road.
Yeah. Well, I liked the one when I was 13 better. I was much lighter then, wirier.
Sure.
I looked like a jerk in this latest picture.
Well, I tell you, would you tell our listeners about your poor height judgment, Mr. Swanson?
Well, you know, life is just a matter of inches. Baseball... Mm-hmm. A ball can be hit a tenth of an inch away from a fielder.
Yeah.
A safe could fall out of a building and miss a guy by half an inch.
Sure.
And sometimes three quarters of an inch could be the difference between...
Well, now, look, I agree that life is a matter of inches, Mr. Swanson.
Right.
Now, then, how high was the underpass, and what was the height of your truck?
Well, the underpass is 11 feet high, and my truck, from the pavement up, runs about 27 feet.
Oh, boy, that must have been quite an impact.
Well, it's funny the way it happened. I was approaching the underpass,
uh-huh.
and I noticed the skull on the gear shift stick wasn't screwed on tight.
It did come loose, everyone.
The head was facing the instrument panel.
And that threw you off,
certainly
huh?
did. Next thing I know, whammo.
Well, it's lucky you didn't get hurt. That's all I can say, Joe.
Well, I have the protection of the foam rubber padding on the dashboard to thank for that. When I hit the underpass, I was thrown against the dashboard and snapped back into the van of the truck.
I see. Well, now, Mr. Swanson, in the picture, you're staring at the contents of the truck scattered all over the road there. Would you tell our listeners what you were transporting?
I was transporting a lot of office equipment. Desks, swivel chairs, filing cabinets, waste baskets, desk sides, coat racks, water coolers, all stuff like that.
And the picture shows the furniture all over the street.
Yeah.
Now, in this one picture, I see a man sitting on one of the swivel chairs that was thrown off the truck, and he's got both thumbs under his suspenders, and he's wiggling his fingers and smoking a cigar. Do you know him?
No, he's some wise guy. Make him believe he's an executive. A lot of guys kid around when something like this happens.
You know, that's the truth. And then I also see a man with a feather duster going over your truck with mock sincerity.
Yeah, I punched him one.
Well, how does your boss feel about all this?
Well, I'm very lucky there. I'm my own boss, so I have nobody to answer to. All the damages I pay for.
You're indeed lucky, Mr. Joseph Swanson.
Yeah.
And thanks for being such a wonderful face in the news. Listeners, a few moments with Leonard Burnside as he explains crooning, its origins, and its place in the musical world. Mr. Leonard Burnside.
Crooning, a cacophony of sound cascading from a verdant musical jungle, or is it a well-planned, throaty accumulation of sounds by a great organizer of melody? We shall see. Mr. Besdale, if you please.
Body Oaten Bodo, Rotten Diddy Bow.
Thank you, Mr. Besdale. Now that we have heard, we begin to wonder. One almost thinks of crooning as a fragmentary bit of Americana, revealing, yet quasi-damaging in its consistency. And while the music is being paraphrased, listen to this strain.
Yada booty doodin do, roadie bada deetin dappin bappin bo.
And so we begin to see what Gerald Dekhart was getting at. Nothing frightening about it, indeed. It's a fructifying experience. You see, Dekhart was not so much interested in musical content as he was in the elasticity of the notes. The music would be sung heartily or with a moue of distaste. Mr. Besdale?
Bada doo dee doo. Oh, bop-dum, bop-dum, dee 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 doo 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 doo.
Slowly we come to terms with crooning, but it was not until 1923 that we realized the dynamism, the inbreeding of crooning with the more stable or unprogresso kind of nation had begun.
The
inculcation, the emergence, the precipitation, the entree, so to speak, the entrance to the back door of music had been accomplished, and there was no going back. I want you to pay particular note to the enchanting Descartes variation here, Mr. Bestdale. How can two themes run concurrently? Well, it's a tribute to the genius of Descartes. While one melody advances rubato, the other recedes contrapuntally into the background, diminuendo, barely making itself heard, only to return with mild
insolence.
If that sounded oppressive, it was exactly what Descartes set out to achieve, the bittersweet. Again, we hear the melancholy yearnings of one sad note overtaking another sad note without taxing the structure. The Weltschmerz of these Descartes outpourings never ceases to amaze me. Mr. Bestdale, if you please finish this particular piece we're dealing with now. So there you have it. Descartes knew that sooner or later you'd have to be dealt with. His music was a force that could not, would not be denied.
In my good old summer time.
So there we have it. Descartes knew that sooner or later he'd have to be dealt with. His music was a force that could not, would not be denied. His was a world of melody. Melody meant all the world to him. I think we must reckon crooning as a serious, yet simpatico art form. Not to do so would be unwise. Bravissimo, my good friend Descartes. I applaud you. Thank you for what you did.
And now to Las Vegas, Nevada, and Wally Ballou.
Wally Ballou speaking from fabulous Las Vegas. Fun spot. People from all over the United States. We're standing in the lobby of the Club Tumbleweed, Las Vegas's newest emporium, a beautiful hotel, expertly appointed, I would say, and I'm chatting with the manager who has high hopes that this first season will be a great send-off to the club. I wonder, Harvey, if you'd come over here and tell us a little bit about your plans for the future.
Well, I'm looking forward to what I hope will be a wonderful year here at my new club. And
somebody's shushing you there.
Yes. Well, we should talk a little more. The club here that I've opened, Wally, will feature more or less a relaxed atmosphere. There will be...
We're broadcasting, lady.
There will be, for instance, tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, there is... reveille, and all the guests file out into the hall, and then march downstairs into the lobby, and we'll go out for a short 4 or 5 mile hike before we come back for an all vegetable breakfast.
I see. You concentrate then on helpful activities here. I hear beautiful music in the background.
Yes, it's a lovely organization that I have here playing music up until 7:15 at night. Of course, it's lights out at 8 o'clock.
That's
everyone's
what I understood.
Tucked away, Betty, bye-bye.
To go to bed. Over here, I see a very beautifully appointed bar. Could you tell us something about this?
Yes. This bar, you can buy any fruit or vegetable juice that you'd want or could ever desire.
I think you told me warm milk is served from 7:30 to 8.
Warm milk with small common crackers.
On the bulletin board, I see that Saturday is bird-watching time. You have
well,
a bird expert?
That will be part of the hike on Saturday. We come back, say, Monday through Friday, and when we come back from the morning hike, we have our vegetable breakfast.
Uh-oh, somebody...
What are you doing?
Somebody dropped a glass of fruit
juice. Didn't like
juice.
The cut of his jib when he signed in here last night.
How many guests do you have at the present time here in Las Vegas at your club?
Six. Six, eh? Yes.
And reservations for how many more?
Well, we don't have any more reservations. We're hoping that by this broadcast,
I'm sure it'll sound good to a great many people. Good luck here at the Tumbleweed in fabulous Las Vegas.
Get him
a
out
real
of
fun spot. And now back to Bob and Ray in New York.
Your letters have indicated a great interest in Mary Magoon's inn up in Turhan Bay, Maine. And with that in view, we've dispatched Wally Ballou there, and he has this tape recording to play for us now that he made, I think, the other evening.
Last Saturday.
All right, Joe, would you thread up that tape, please? The next voice will be Wally Ballou's.
Next voice you will hear will be that of me, Wally Ballou, 17-time award winner of Radio Diction. Speaking to you from the veranda of the Mary Magoon Inn, overlooking beautiful Turhan Bay here on the coast of Maine. Mary is in the kitchen at the moment and told me that as soon as we took the air, she has a little radio up the kitchen. As soon as she heard us come on the radio, she would come out chatting with us. Tonight, she is inaugurating the new entertainment policy. She is auditioning an orchestra that she may hire as a regular feature of the... Here she comes through the screen door now. Hello, Mary.
Wally! Hello there. How are you?
Did you hear us on the radio out in the kitchen?
Yes, we have a small little radio set out there, and I was listening, and I heard you introducing me, so I hurried on in.
Fine. How does the crowd look to you from here?
I don't know how to judge. I know we only have four people, and three of them are ladies.
How many meals have you served today? Or this evening?
Well, I think only one is going to eat tonight. The others are just more or less sitting around eating the olives and the celery. I think one is ordered at dinner.
You have the 14 waiters standing by that you hired?
Yes, they're all standing by, ready to wait on the customers, providing we have enough.
Is that the salad boy over there?
Yes, that's Nicholas. He's from Calais.
There seems to be a great deal of excitement in regard to this orchestra you've hired. Could you tell us something about that, and will we get a chance to hear them?
Yes, they're all over there. They're lobster fishermen.
Uh-huh.
And in their spare time, they've all studied music, instruments. And there are about 10 of them, and they form this little organization, and they play for all the socials around town. And I thought...
Real local musicians.
The real local Maine musicians.
Uh-huh.
And they're over there now. And I thought that a little music on Saturday night might help.
Right. Then there may be some dancing, I guess, a little bit later.
Well, we certainly hope so.
Somebody else shows up.
He's due to start playing any moment now.
Let's have a little sample of that Down East music there now, shall we?
All right, Vernon. Vernon, would you play...
Hey, yeah.
Will you play some music now for the radio folks?
Okay, baby.
Dancing together. Well, get off the floor, girls.
They don't have anybody else to dance with. So, from the beautiful Mary Magoon Inn overlooking Turhan Bay on the coast of Maine, we've been listening to the music of Vernon Peabody, his trumpet, his trombone, his guitar, his marimba, and his orchestra. And this is Radio's Wally Ballou, returning it now to our studio. Again in the sports room, ready to talk to our guest, the legendary grand old man of football, in an off-season football interview with Coach Pop O'Brien of the Golden Cougars of Midwest University. Say hello to all your fans out there, Pop.
Well, hello, pigskin lovers out there.
Pop, I guess you're pretty much of a legend, aren't you?
Well, I guess you might say that I was born at a gridiron bed.
Where'd you get the nickname of Pop, Pop?
Well, most people credit Slipper Hanley with inventing my nickname, but the truth is, I gave Slipper Hanley his nickname.
That's all?
I was the first one to call him Slipper.
Slipper Hanley. I guess he's a bigger legend than even you are, Pop.
No, I think I'm a bigger legend.
Well, when your team, the Golden Cougars, are in the dressing room getting ready for the big game...
Well, they're all big, Biff. Every
doesn't
one
the
of
team
them.
Say, let's win this one for the old slipper?
Well, yes, they do, Biff, but it's not that dramatic.
Well, a picture of the team in the locker room at halftime, kids fighting back tears because they're losing the game, the brooding silence, and suddenly a voice with quiet resolve says, let's win this one for the old slipper. It is moving, Pop.
Well, not if you know Slipper. He's a prominent industrialist, and he's in with the showbiz crowd. He's flashy, and he knows Frank Sinatra. And he's got a stable of four fighters, and he wears two rings on his pinky. Recently, I saw a picture of him in the window of a restaurant shaking hands with Gene Fulmer.
And I believe he recently acquired a piece of a Las Vegas casino, too.
That's right. He just bought into the Pink Bandit. I believe it's run by the syndicate.
I've heard that, Pop. What's the deal, do you know?
Well, just as soon as the papers were signed, giving Slipper 25% of the Pink Bandit, he had to turn over his full 25% interest to the syndicate. That's the only way they let him operate.
Well, if he'd turned over the full 25%, he doesn't own anything.
Well, the syndicate's pretty rough, Biff. Incidentally, about Slipper, recently he was given a solid gold cigarette case, a gift from a renowned continental beauty.
I didn't know that, Pop.
It's true. Now, Biff, knowing all this stuff about Slipper, I don't understand how any member of the team could say, let's win this one for the old Slipper.
Well, I see what you mean. It just doesn't sound right. It would sound right if Slipper were an old, shaky man being helped into the stadium, his memory fading a bit, not quite knowing which team is which. A man with shoulders bent by a million burdensome problems. But above all, a man who shouldn't be out in the stadium on such a cold day. In short, Pop, a man like you.
That's what I thought, yeah.
But the fact is, on the day of the game, your players still say, let's win this one for the old slipper. How come they don't want to win it for you, Pop?
Well, there's no accounting for tastes. I guess you know that, Biff. Maybe my voice is too raspy. I think that's probably the reason. It gets on their nerves.
I don't think that's the reason. If it were, the players could very well say on the day of the big game...
Well, they're all big, Biff.
Let's win this one for raspy-voiced old Pop.
Well, that doesn't sound very good, Biff.
Well, the only other reason I can see for the players not giving you vocal homage in the locker room is the fact that the Golden Cougars haven't won a game since 1949.
That's right. You can't win them all, Biff.
Don't I know it, Pop. Legendary coach of the Golden Gophers of Midwest University. This is... Cougars, excuse me. This is Biff Burns saying until next time. This is Biff Burns saying so long from the sports room. Welcoming you to another edition of Sportsophone. You all know how we play the game. I'll start describing a famous sports figure, and as soon as you think you know who it is, call me Johnny Braddock at Pickering 6. The first person with the correct answer will win a valuable prize, and let's go now. The sports figure I'm thinking of has many times been involved in tape measure home runs. His initials are M.M.
Braddock. The guy you're talking about is Mikkel Mantle. He's been involved in tape measure home runs, okay? I send a valuable prize to Lou Cornshafter, care of B. Ragsdale, Pulver Heights, Maryland.
I'm sorry, Mr. Cornshafter, but there'll be no valuable prize for you. Mikkel Mantle is not the correct answer.
Boy, what a con artist you are, Braddock. You can't stand it if someone guesses right, can you? You change the sports figure in midair if a guy guesses.
It's a serious charge, Mr. Cornshafter. Ordinarily, I'd demand satisfaction from you, but it would involve an expensive trip to Maryland and a good deal of tedium once I got there.
Well, if it ain't Mikkel Mantle, who is it? I mean, Braddock, who hits a ball that long that has to be measured?
The answer to that, Mr. Cornshafter, is in our underground vault, tucked away from prying eyes. And Mr. Minnithy, our accountant, is standing guard over the vault, ledger book in hand, ready to do battle, flail away at intruders if need be.
Horse feathers, Braddock. You're a phony and you know it.
Thank you for the kind appellation, Mr. Cornshafter. Goodbye.
Baloney.
Now, the sports figure I'm thinking of, the one involved in tape measure home runs, was a boy who gained wind and endurance by running the tape measure from home plate to the deepest part of the bleachers. A sickly lad at first.
Oscar Levant.
No, sir.
Cheat.
A sickly lad at first.
I got your clue, Mr. Braddock. It's
got to be Musial, Scarron, Hodges, Cepeda, Mickey Vernon, or any one of a bunch of other first basemen.
What makes you think our famous sports figure is a first baseman?
Well, I thought the key words, the clue, so to speak, were the words at first.
Well, I wouldn't say the first baseman you just mentioned were sickly. They all seem robust to me.
Well, Braddock, who made you a doctor? You got trouble enough lying on your program without getting into the field of medicine. I'll bet you don't even know the difference between measles and mumps.
Yes, I do. The difference is about an inch and a half.
Very funny, Braddock. I'll take vanilla.
And this sickly lad grew up and became a champion swimmer who appeared in many Olympic contests. Later, he played the role of Tarzan in many movies. His first name is Johnny. His last initial is W.
This is Corey Shafter from Maryland again. You got my address. Don't horse around, Braddock. The guy you're talking about is Johnny Weissbaugh. Tarzan in the movie. Send a valuable prize.
You're wrong again, Cornshafter. The figure I'm thinking of is Johnny Williams.
Braddock, this guy Johnny Williams, he never played Tarzan in the movies, did he?
Not that I know of, Cornshafter.
But you said he did.
I made a mistake.
I'll get you for this, Braddock. On a dark night, I'll get you.
Yeah, this is Johnny Braddock closing out another edition of Sports Info. Here now is a gentleman we'd like to introduce whose work you may have seen in the bookstores, a writer of popular children's stories, Mr. August T. May.
Hello, Bob. It is a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you, Mr. May. And I wonder, just to refresh some of our memories, you could tell us a few of the books that you have written and which have had quite some success.
Well, maybe you remember the book I wrote for children. It was a children's book.
Yes.
The book's title was The Sky Fell Down.
I remember that one. My kids really
enjoyed
it.
It was a story for children. See, Bob, look. I'm wearing a blue suit.
I noticed that.
This is a new blue suit.
Very stylish with narrow lapels.
Do I look nice in a blue suit?
Yes, you do, Mr. May.
Oh, there is my dog, Spot.
Now, Mr. May, I understand that as a writer of... will you take Spot out right at the moment? He's...
Please, take the dog out. His name is Spot. Thank you for being kind to my dog.
He is
His
a funny
name
dog.
Is Spot. I love to run and play with Spot
yes.
in my new blue suit.
Well, I tell you, Mr. May, what we really wanted to talk about was the job you did during the campaign, the recent campaigns, in the line of helping out a senator that you were working for.
A representative I was working for.
Uh-huh.
And I was hired to go on children's programs.
Well, he can
on
see...
radio and on television.
Right.
Do you know the difference
yes,
between
I do.
Radio and television?
I think we all do.
Yes, we know the answer.
Well, if we may move along, Mr. May, this representative conceived the idea of getting at the parents via the children
yes.
and their programs. And so he hired you to write speeches and to go on the kids' shows. And I understand you're going to give us a sample of what you did.
Yes.
Are you? Here then is children's book author August T. May and his political speech.
Hello to all my young friends. It is August T. May. I'm happy to be here to talk to you again. I have talked to you many times in my books. Do you remember my children's books? One called The Little Weeping Willow Tree That Cried? I bet you do. Now, I'm going to talk to you on the radio. I would like to talk to you about a nice man. His name is Jack Spratt. He's a very nice man. This nice man lived for 4 whole years. Now, when he gets there, and when he lives there, he will make very nice laws for your mommy and daddy. He will make wonderful laws that will lower those big, bad taxes and give money to your mommy and daddy so that they can buy you toys. And candy and ice cream. Run now out to the kitchen and tell Mommy to be sure and vote for Jack Spratt. He's a very nice man.
I think we get the idea.
Oh, there is Gina Lola Brigida.
All right.
I must run and play with
Mr.
Gina.
Mr. Augustine, a very sneaky way. And how did Mr. Spratt make out? Can you tell us at this time?
Both he and I were arrested.
It's
on an appeal now.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, hold everything, friends.
That's right. Stop whatever you're doing, because this time I think the makers of Bob and Ray stuff have really done it.
I know they have. They've added another to the list of things you can be immune to.
Now, you can be immunized to typhoid, typhus, and a host of other diseases, but now, thanks to you-know-who,
you can get diplomatic immunity. You heard right. Now you can get diplomatic immunity.
A lot of you probably are saying that diplomatic is not a disease, and you're right, it's not.
But did you know that all diplomats from foreign lands are immune from income tax and such other legal scourges as parking and speeding tickets and prosecution for a wide assortment of other petty crime?
Well, that's to say, upon presenting the credentials of their respective countries, they cannot be arrested or detained in any way.
Great, huh? Well, how have we, two lovable but uninfluential radio broadcasters, gotten such immunity? And how can we offer it to others, you're asking? And well, you might.
We've gotten it through the simple expedient of setting up our own country on a small island just outside the legal limits of the continental United States.
This country we've named Transylvania because up till now, it was only the name of a fictitious country used in Dracula pictures. Therefore, it sounds familiar, and most people think they know where it is.
We've also set up a Transylvanian embassy in an old store in the low-rent district of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C.
Our application is in for U.N. membership, and we're thinking of joining the Cold War on the side of the free world. So you can see, we're really in the diplomatic swing of things.
But now, what other benefits accrue to those having our diplomatic immunity other than living in a state of mild lawlessness responsible only to Transylvania, which couldn't care less?
Well, the benefits are many. First of all, your name is put on the mailing lists of all the more popular countries so that you are constantly being invited to important diplomatic functions and lavish embassy parties.
You get to meet hundreds of interesting people, travel around the world, all expenses paid, to look at dams, roads, and other monuments to progress.
Not only that, but Transylvania has applied for and may be the recipients of generous foreign aid. The money to be used to build a giant hotel, cabana club, gambling casino on the island. This will be used for you and your loved ones should you, by abusing your privileges, be expelled from the United States.
With your Bob and Ray immunity kit, you get free of charge, besides your passport and other official-looking documents, a set of diplomatic license plates with the abbreviation DPL, a book on protocol with chapters on bowing and scraping, cheek kissing, heel clicking, and Yankee baiting.
A sash to wear with the formal clothes you'll have to buy in Transylvania's national colors. Persimmon, burnt umber, and cerise. Do you like them?
Finally, a collection of bright, shiny medals, including the coveted Order of Count Basie.
Now, we still have a few legal loopholes to plug up on this thing.
Like possible loss of your American citizenship?
However, we have every reason to believe they'll be cleared up and cleared up soon. So, we're taking applications now. If you're interested, simply write on a card, "Make me immune, Bob and Ray," and mail it to Transylvanian Consulate, New York.
That's Transylvanian Consulate, New York.
What, officer? Work on.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think you'll enjoy meeting an actor whom you've all seen on television innumerable times, though maybe you don't know his name. Say hello to everybody, Wally Payne.
Hello, folks.
Into this microphone, Wally.
Hi, folks, and hello, Bob.
Get right into the story of how you got into this unusual acting specialization, that of pain and discomfort scenes, Wally.
Well, I started out as a movie extra, Bob, but it seems that I was always being singled out to play roles that call for someone in severe pain.
Yes, well, you look as if you're in pain right now, are you?
No, not at all. I never felt better, but that explains how I was always being chosen for such roles. It's my face. Even when I just stand around, it looks as though there's an awful throbbing going on inside my head.
So if you half try, you can feign unbearable anguish, is that right?
Well, that's the truth of the matter. Yes, trying to look normal, healthy, and of good cheer, as required in before and after commercials, was very hard for me to master.
Master Bob. Now, as far as commercials go, the one you're best known for, I guess, is for a popular pain-relieving drug. Shows you standing there with a pleasant face.
Which I put on.
And then the announcer says, "What happens when a headache strikes?"
Then I go into a look of terrible torment, guaranteed to make any viewer shudder.
Yeah, and then some animated machinery is superimposed over your brain to make the pain more graphic. I think that's superfluous because you do the role so well.
Thank you very much. Figuring I'm not the only person with a pained expression, I keep my mouth shut there. Why bite the hand, you know what I mean?
That feeds you. Another commercial you do that I admire is the cold, misery, and hay fever one, where you make it look like those 8 sinus cavities are really working full blast.
I have 9 sinus cavities, and that's why I get such a real painful look, and I actually have hay fever. For realism, we film those commercials for the entire year in a field of ragweed.
Wow.
During the hay fever season. I really was suffering in those commercials.
Now, of all the roles you've played, Wally, such as sharp, piercing pain, dull, throbbing pain, tired, worn-out feeling, or sore, aching muscles, which gives you, as a performer, the most satisfaction, could you say?
Oh, I guess I find the one in which I trade a headache for an upset stomach the most challenging and rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
Although severe itching parts also gives me a chance to move around a bit and display my dancing ability.
I think I read somewhere that your wife is in this business, too, isn't she?
Used to be, but not anymore.
Oh.
She was with the upset stomach heartburn people, but they went in for big name and my wife was out.
Oh, you mean Elsa Maxwell. How do you feel about her portrayal of heartburn?
Well, I'd have to say she's pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm.
When she self-consciously brings a hand to her mouth, it's very realistic, you know, that she's acting.
Yeah, well, I think Elsa's a natural. Now, Wally, by way of a wrap-up, what, if any, are your future plans?
Bob, something a little different for me. First, we're doing a short trial stint, right as I am, as a sick comic.
Mm-hmm. Should be good.
Then there's a set of unruly hair commercials coming up for me, and then it's off to work on a pilot film for a new TV series titled I Married a Hypochondriac.
Good.
Situation comedy. We hope to get Ann Southern to co-star.
Well, it sounds great, Wally Payne, and all of Bob and Ray Locke in the world.
Payne again.
Oh, yes. Thank you for stopping by.
It look all right?